what they said on the ITU when they wanted to turn the ventilator off, his mother said, a voice choking with anger. That keeping him on the ventilator was upsetting for the staff. But these people are paid. They are paid to do their job. She became so angry that she rushed out of the room. I followed her out of the hospital into the afternoon sunlight to find her standing in the car park opposite the main entrance. I'm sorry that I shouted, I said. I find this all very difficult. I thought you would be furious when you heard about his death, she said to me in a disappointed voice. I know that it's difficult for you. She waved her arm at the building behind us. You have a duty to the hospital. I'm not trying to cover up for anybody, I replied. I don't like this place and have no loyalty to it whatsoever. As we talked, we had started to walk back to the steel and glass front entrance to the hospital. The constant passage of people coming and going through the automatic doors made it feel more like a railway station. I took her back to my office, past the threatening notice at the entrance to the outpatient clinic, which I had once got into trouble for denouncing on the radio. This trust, states the notice, operates a policy of withholding treatment from violent and abusive patients. It was ironic, I thought, how the notice expressed the hospital management's distrust of patients, and it was a corresponding lack of trust in the hospital which was now tormenting Darren's mother. She collected her bag from my office and left without saying anything more. I went back up to the wards. I met one of my registrars on the staircase. I've just seen Darren's mother, I said to him. It was pretty grim. There'd been a lot of problems when the boy was dying on the ITU, he replied. She wouldn't let us turn the ventilator off, even though he was brain dead. I had no problem with that, but some of the anaesthetic staff got pretty difficult over the weekend, and some of the nurses were refusing to look after him since he was brain dead. Oh dear, I said. I remembered how angry I had been myself many years ago at how my own son had almost died due to what I felt had been the carelessness of one of the doctors looking after him when he had been admitted to hospital with his brain tumour. I also remembered how, after I had become a neurosurgeon myself, I had operated on a young girl with a large brain tumour. The tumour was a mass of blood vessels, in the way that some brain tumours can be, and I had struggled desperately to stop the bleeding. The operation became a grim race between the blood pouring out of the child's head and my poor anaesthetist Judith pouring blood back in through the intravenous lines as I tried and failed to stop the bleeding. The child, a very beautiful girl with long red hair, bled to death. She died on the table, an exceptionally rare event in modern surgery. As I completed the procedure, stitching together the scalp of the now dead patient, there was utter silence in the operating theatre. The normal sounds of the place, the chatter of the staff, the hissing of the ventilator, the bleeping of the anaesthetic monitors, had suddenly stopped. All of us in the theatre avoided each other's eyes in the presence of death, and in the face of such utter failure. And as I closed the dead child's head, I had to think about what to tell the waiting family. I had dragged myself up to the children's ward, where the mother was waiting to see me. She would not have been expecting to hear this catastrophic news. I had found it very difficult to talk, but managed to convey what had happened. I had no idea how she might react, but she reached out to me and held me in her arms and consoled me for my failure, even though it was she who had lost her daughter. Doctors need to be held accountable, since power corrupts. There must be complaints procedures and litigation, commissions of inquiry, punishment and compensation. At the same time, if you do not hide or deny any mistakes when things go wrong, and if your patients and their families know that you are distressed by whatever happened, you might, if you are lucky, receive the precious gift of forgiveness. As far as I know, Darren's mother did not pursue her complaint, but I fear that if she cannot find it in her heart to forgive the doctors who looked after her son in his final illness, she will be haunted forever by his dying cry. Chapter 16. Pituitary adenoma. Noun. A benign tumour of the pituitary gland. By the time that I became a consultant in 1987, I was already an experienced surgeon. I was appointed to replace the senior surgeon at the hospital where I had been training, and as the senior surgeon wound down his career, he had delegated most of his operating to me. Once you become a consultant, you are suddenly responsible for your patients in a way that you never were as a junior and trainee. You come to look back on your years of training as an almost carefree time. As a trainee, the ultimate responsibility for any mistakes that you might make are ultimately borne by your consultant and not by yourself. As I get older, I find the self-assurance of many of my trainees, for whose mistakes I am responsible, a little irritating, but I was no different myself once. This all changes when you become a consultant. My first few months in the role passed without incident. I was then referred a man with acromegaly. The disease is caused by a small tumour in the pituitary gland producing excess growth hormone. The person's face slowly changes. It becomes heavy and block-like, not unlike the cartoon figure Desperate Dan in the Dandy magazine, with a massive jaw and forehead. The feet enlarge, and the hands become large and spade-like. The changes in this patient's case were not especially severe, and often the changes are so gradual over so many years that most patients and their families do not notice them. If one knew he had the condition, one might notice that his jaw was a little heavy. The high levels of growth hormone ultimately damage the heart, and it is for that reason, not the cosmetic changes, that we operate. The operation is done through the nostril, since the pituitary gland lies beneath the brain at the top of the nasal cavities and is usually simple and straightforward. There are, however, two major arteries next to the pituitary gland that can, if the surgeon is exceptionally unlucky, be damaged during the operation. His wife and three daughters had all come with him to my office when I first saw him. They were Italian and had become extremely emotional when I said that surgery would be required. They were obviously a close and loving family. Despite their anxieties about the operation, they expressed great confidence in me. He was a particularly nice person. I had been in to see him on the Sunday evening before the operation, and we talked happily together for a while. It is a pleasant feeling when your patient obviously trusts you so completely. I operated the next day, and the operation went well. He awoke perfectly. I went round to see him late that evening, and his wife and daughters were full of praise and thanks, which I happily acknowledged. The next day, some of the symptoms of acromegaly, the feeling that his fingers were swollen, were already a little better, and on Thursday morning I went to see him before he went home. When I went to his bed and spoke to him, he looked blankly back at me and said nothing. I then noticed that his right arm was lying useless beside him. One of the nurses hurried up to the bedside. "We were trying to find you," she said. "We think he must have had a stroke just a few minutes ago." My patient and I looked uncomprehendingly at each other. I could scarcely believe, and he could not understand, what was happening. I felt a bitter wave of dread and disappointment break over me. Struggling against this, I did my best to reassure him, though he would not have understood the words, that all would be well. But a brain scan later that morning confirmed a major stroke in his left cerebral hemisphere. This must have been caused in some unknowable way by the operation. He was by now aphasic, utterly without language. He did not seem too distressed by this, so presumably had little awareness of the problem and was living in some strange, language-less world like a speechless animal.